This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
And even with the death of its founder, Yevgeny Prigozhin, there's still so much around this group that we haven't spoken about that we need to tell the world about.
That's a Nigerian journalist, Philip Obagi Jr., who has won a fellowship to continue looking at the actions of Russian mercenary group Wagner. Details coming up. Also, the UN says it will help mobilize $30 billion a year for water security and sanitation in Africa. And Spain's Catalonia region is training migrants largely from Africa to operate tractors. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. 4 years, Nigerian journalist Philip Obagi Jr. has investigated the actions of Russian mercenary group Wagner. It's a beat that comes with challenges. VOA's news reporter Christina Casedo-Smith has the story.
As an investigative journalist in Nigeria, Philip Obagi Jr. has covered a lot over the years, including extremist groups, human trafficking, and abuse of civil liberties. But one story really captured the attention of this reporter for the Daily Beast, Russia's Wagner Group in West Africa.
And even with the death of its founder, Yevgeny Prigozhin, there's still so much around this group that we haven't spoken about that we need to tell the world about.
Obagi will continue his reporting on the mercenary organization through a Jim Hogue Reporting Fellowship, awarded by the International Center for Journalists, or ICFJ. The ICFJ honored Obagi and other journalists in Washington late September. Alison Grossom is program director at the International Center for Journalists.
So these journalists have different approaches to telling really interesting stories, often about communities that are undercovered in the regular media.
Obagi's interest in Wagner Group started in 2018, when three Russian journalists were killed on a remote road in the Central African Republic. The trio was investigating the activities of Russian military contractors in the area. Philip Obagi is an investigative journalist in Nigeria.
And I wanted to really know exactly what this group was doing in that country. And so that's why I picked up interest. And each time I ask questions, there's always another question to ask, because I get answers that really leaves gaps in between.
But covering such a story has its risks.
I mean, three Russian journalists went to investigate and then they got killed. Local journalists will try to investigate or ask questions about the Wagner Group, either get disappeared or somehow targeted by whether it's Wagner or government forces.
The nonprofit Press Freedom Organization Reporters Without Borders describes the Central African Republic as a dangerous place, where journalists are often the targets of threats and violence and subject to pressure from both armed groups and authorities.
That coverage is hardly there in the country because of fear. Yeah, so, but there are brave local journalists who try to work, you know, anonymously with the foreign media to help these stories get out.
With many journalists fearful of covering sensitive issues and sources scared to go on record, reporting on groups like Wagner, it's tough. So fellowships like the one Obagi received can help reporters cover difficult stories and reach wider audiences. Alison Grossom of the International Center for Journalists.
It is a really interconnected and global society, and what happens in Africa or what happens in South America have ramifications on how we choose to act and what we choose to support and how we want to move forward as a global community.
After his brief visit to Washington, Obagi returns to Nigeria to continue his work on a long-form project focused on the Wagner Group. Christina Caicedo-Smith, VOA News, Washington.
A huge fire erupted at a police facility in the Egyptian Suez Canal city of Islamia early today, injuring at least 38 people before firefighters contained the blaze after several hours, according to emergency services and media reports. Video posted on social media showed the city's security directorate engulfed in flames. The cause of the fire was not immediately known. Two witnesses told Reuters news agency that firefighters initially appeared to struggle to tackle the blaze. More than 3 hours later, state television said it had been contained. Civil defense sources said parts of the building had collapsed in the fire. Spain's agricultural sector is threatened by an aging population and a shortage of farm labor. Now a program in Catalonia is training migrants, largely from Africa, to operate tractors to help them gain meaningful employment. Elizabeth Chernev narrates this report from Alfonso Biatu in Barcelona.
The recent string of coups in Africa, as well as natural disasters in Morocco and Libya, point to an instability that has some leaders in Europe bracing for continued migration from the region. Among them is the European Union's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell.
We have been directly affected by the events in the Sahel, as neighbors, as partners. This is also why migration and security are key elements we need to take into account in our strategy that guides our action in development cooperation.
Spain is often the first stop for migrant flows from the Sahel, and many immigrants are looking for farm jobs. Language and lack of skills, even in farm work, are barriers to being hired. These young Africans live, work, and learn on this facility in the countryside. Jose Maria Monter, a project foreman, organizes the day's work. He says the migrants come to Spain with the idea of improving on what they had in their homeland. They appreciate very much what little you can teach them. The facility is owned by the nonprofit OTA Foundation, part of a public-private partnership that includes the Raymond Leda Community Foundation, which is collaborating with farm equipment manufacturer John Deere and U.S.-based nonprofit United Way to teach the young migrants how to use the machinery. Operating farm equipment involves teamwork and serves to combat social exclusion, while picking fruit and other manual work can be lonely and monotonous. Mamadou Diallo, who is from Gambia, seized the opportunity to learn to drive a tractor. He says that he likes to work with tractors and has thought a long time about getting a tractor license. Spain has one of the lowest fertility rates in Europe. Many young people are also migrating to urban areas, leaving much of the countryside empty. Jose Maria Monter, the OTA Foundation project foreman, says the biggest problem today in Spain is the lack of workers. The initiative, backed by the Catalan government, provides an official tractor operator certification. It also gives young migrants a chance to find meaningful work and a place in Spanish society, while doing their part to help the country regenerate its dying countryside. For Alfonso Beato in Barcelona, Elizabeth Chernev, VOA News.
Denise Mukwege announced a presidential bid today for December elections in the Democratic Republic of Congo. According to the French news agency AFP, Mukwege, a 68-year-old surgical gynecologist who won the 2018 Nobel Prize, told supporters he is running to end insecurity and poor leadership. Mukwege was jointly awarded the Nobel Peace Prize alongside Yazidi activist Nadia Murad for efforts to end sexual violence as a weapon of war. The pioneering doctor founded the Panzi Hospital and Foundation in conflict-torn eastern DRC after witnessing the horrific injuries and diseases suffered by rape victims. Parliamentary and presidential elections are scheduled for December 20th. Incumbent President Felix Tshisekedi is running for re-election. The earthquake that killed nearly 3,000 people in Morocco's High Atlas Mountains last month also took a toll on the region's flourishing tourist industry, a key source of jobs and income. The raft of tourist cancellations adds to the many challenges facing impoverished mountain communities as they begin the difficult task of rebuilding. Lisa Bryan reports for VOA from the Moroccan town of Amizmiz.
Tourists from around the world come to the High Atlas to discover its rugged beauty and the ethnic Amazigh or Berbers who live here. Abdel Samad El Zghouli is a local tour guide.
The traditional way of living You know about the hospitality of people in mountains. It's like enormous. So people, when they come and meet people smiling and like they are welcome in their house, and this affects a lot like tourists.
The earthquake has demolished many mountain villages that charmed El Zguli's customers and parts of Amizmiz, where he lives, a jumping off point for exploring the High Atlas. El Zguli and his neighbors sleep outside, fearful of returning to their earthquake-damaged homes. Tourism was a windfall for this impoverished and underdeveloped region. The quake has changed that.
Of course, the impact is going to be big, enormous, because today and for a certain period of time, there won't be no one.
That was French hotel owner Bruno Dubois-Roquebert, who opened the first hotel in Amizmiz in 2005. The quake spared his lodge and staff. Old guests are contacting him to offer help. Tour guide El Zguli's future is uncertain, but for now, he's a man with a mission. He helped to organize this camp for people left homeless by the quake.
I'm doing my best to help. And for the future, it's a mystery. I don't know, and I don't think about it.
His family survived the earthquake. For him, that's what matters in the end. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Amizmiz, Morocco.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The United Nations has announced it will help mobilize $30 billion a year for water security and sanitation in Africa. The plan is being guided by the UN High-Level Panel on Water Investments. Darren Taylor reports.
At the recent United Nations General Assembly in New York, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres described water as a human right.
Water is humanity's lifeblood. From the food we eat to the ecosystems and biodiversity that enrich our world, to the prosperity that sustain nations, to the economic engines of agriculture, manufacturing, and energy generation, to our health, hygiene, and survival itself.
But a joint UN World Health Organization report released last year says one in three Africans are affected by water scarcity. It says 411 million people in Africa lack clean drinking water, and 780 million don't have water sanitation services. In total, about 840 million Africans lack access to basic hygiene. The UN and its partners want to see those numbers greatly reduced by 2030. One of these partners is the Development Bank of Southern Africa, the DBSA. The man in charge of infrastructure delivery at the bank, Chwene Rampele, says the DBSA is in a position to leverage money from international investors to improve water security across the continent.
Most of the budgets of the countries, especially in Africa, were really so constrained that there's no money at all. But the heads of states have committed to say they will make sure that 5% of their annual budgets will really be dedicated for water projects.
Rampele, however, says this is ambitious, and it's a pledge that many African nations could struggle to live up to. In that case, he says, the UN and its partners could turn to traditional global financing mechanisms, such as the World Bank, for help. Rampele says the money will be used to build infrastructure capacity across Africa, especially water pipes. He's concerned, though, about changing weather patterns and flooding in particular.
It can really be very catastrophic, and you need to really be coming up to the point that you are looking at pipes that are really resilient to the weather. Like if you go to Japan, you'll find that they have designed pipes that even if there is any earthquake, those particular pipelines don't necessarily then get to be affected because they move with the earthquakes and so on.
Rampele says there needs to be a lot of development in African river basins.
And particularly making sure that when these rains are falling also, we're able to then harvest that particular water, not for it to just all disappear in the sea, and making sure that the way that we build up our dams and infrastructure is more resilient to the climate itself. we're building up systems now to ensure that at least the hydrological data can really be harnessed, and we begin to use it to improve the capacity of each and every country to know how you manage this investment.
He says he's confident that $17 billion raised within Africa by organizations such as the DBSA will soon be available to begin constructing new dams, for example. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Pope Francis on Saturday further cemented his legacy, elevating 21 prelates to the high rank of cardinal. The new cardinals hailed from 15 nations, three of them from Africa, South Africa, South Sudan, and Tanzania. South Sudan now has its first cardinal. It was the Pope's ninth consistory, or gathering of cardinals, since his election in 2013, and continued changes over the past decades, during which the percentage of Asian and African cardinal electors has grown, while that of those from Europe has fallen. For more on the new cardinals, I talked with Father Paul Samasumo, head of Vatican Radio's Africa service in English.
On Saturday was a special meeting, a ceremony that is known as the consistory. This is when cardinals meet. So cardinals this time were meeting for Pope Francis to make or create, that's the word used, to create new cardinals, the 21 cardinals that he appointed recently. And after that, then they are known as cardinals. They are his closest advisors. Some of them work in the dicastery. Some of them work in their various areas where they live around the world. I think one of the most interesting features since Pope Francis became Pope is that he has tried as much as possible. He appoints cardinals from a wide range of the geographical range of the world, and that has made the universality of the church much more vivid. Sometimes these cardinals are not very well known, but the fact that he appoints them, they don't come from very big cities or big regions, that the church should be very universal in its outlook. Among those 21 cardinals appointed were also a cardinal from South Sudan, Stephen Ameyo, Archbishop Stephen Ameyo, now Cardinal Stephen Ameyo. And also we have the Archbishop of Cape Town, Stephen Breslin, as well as another Archbishop from Tanzania. This is Rugambwa. Cardinal Rugambwa has been working in the dicasteries of the Vatican for quite some time now, until recently when he was appointed to go to Tanzania.
Talk to us a little about the new South Sudan cardinal.
Even in Africa, the kind of appointments, we have a relatively young bishop of South Sudan from a relatively young nation, South Sudan, independent only in 2011. And unfortunately, after 2011, there was that war, the civil war that occurred, the conflict. They are trying to make a peace. Now the political actors have come together. And we've seen that over the years, Pope Francis, the Church, the Vatican has been encouraging this peace process in South Sudan. The Holy Father also visited South Sudan towards the beginning of this year, if I'm not mistaken. It was all part of encouraging this peace process. So I think the appointment, particularly of the cardinal in South Sudan in Juba, the Archbishop of Juba, Stephen Ameyo, is to encourage this peace process. We saw how he conducted himself when the Holy Father visited South Sudan. That made him much more visible, and they did exceptionally well, given the circumstances that this is a country that has been at war for a very, very long time. There is hardly any infrastructure in South Sudan, but they still did well.
Father, lastly, you know, Pope Francis has selected 21 new cardinals to help reform the Catholic Church, leaning heavily on diversity, like you said, just days ahead of a meeting where he's supposed to outline plans for future to discuss controversial issues such as LGBTQ plus followers, women's roles in the church, and celibacy.
Well, these 21 cardinals actually become part of a larger college of other cardinals who are already there. So what is happening this week, for the whole month of October, there will be a meeting where that is known as the synod. This synod meeting is usually for bishops, but Pope Francis again has widened it a bit and called different participants from around the world. So it's not only cardinals that are meeting, almost I think close to 400 persons, if I'm not mistaken, will be meeting for the whole month of October. And it's not to reform the church, but what they're trying to do is they are trying to listen to the needs of the church today. What kind of a church do people want? What kind of the church is the Holy Spirit asking for us to become? And he has already, the Pope, Pope Francis, has emphasized that he wants this body, this process, this one-month process, to be a listening process. And apart from those topics you've outlined, there also everything is on the table for discussion. This process actually began months before. The same process of discussion has been happening in the dioceses, in the country, at continental level, and now they are meeting on a world stage. This is the synod meeting that will be happening here in the Vatican for the month of October.
That was Father Paul Samasumo, head of the Vatican Radio Africa Service in English. Botswana will now permit more than 1,000 refugees there to seek opportunities to earn a living. Previously, refugees were only allowed to leave the refugee camp only for reasons other than employment. From Habrone, Botswana, reporter Mokondisi Dube has the details.
The Botswana Minister of Justice, Machana Shamukuni, told the refugees they can seek odd jobs to sustain their livelihoods. Shamukuni said on Thursday, the government and the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, UNHCR, do not have sufficient funds for the refugees' upkeep.
The UNHCR representative has just indicated that as an organization, they are facing financial challenges and are unable to provide for some of the basic needs that they are supposed to provide to you. Even as the government of Botswana, we have not been spared. We haven't fully recovered from the debilitating effects of COVID.
He says the refugees have to ensure they are safe while outside the camp. The Refugee Welfare Committee Chairperson, Patience Dagawona, says the move to allow refugees to seek employment will help augment their food rations.
The refugee community is very, very happy to be allowed to go outside the camp and look for informal jobs, which are mainly known as peace jobs. By so doing, we'll be supplementing to the food basket which we are getting from UNHCR. And we can also put food on our table. We can also buy the other things, the other items which we are not receiving from UNHCR.
Minister Shamukuni says the government is considering a proposal from the refugees to fund students up to tertiary level. Currently, the government only funds education up to secondary school.
As situations improve, I'm hopeful that as we continuously engage as government, as police, with other stakeholders, we should see some bit of progress in this proposal where we would be in a position to support students.
Shamukuni also says refugees must consider voluntary repatriation and return to their home countries, particularly in light of budgetary constraints. Botswana is home to refugees fleeing conflict, mostly from the Horn of Africa and the Democratic Republic of Congo. For VOA, this is Mqondisi Dube in Habrone, Botswana.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yeheye Swuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Bob Bass, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.